from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Fortan. Today I continue my relentless quest to interview individuals I find interesting and fascinating, whose works I've read and whose stuff I want to expose you guys to. Today my guest has so many jobs, I think that he probably needs one of those extra long business cards just to incorporate everything. He's written a book that's I read about a year ago, and I actually had him on the show before, and then I lost the audio. So I'm happy to have him again on the show, Dr. Andy Thompson. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I was referring to the incident where we've done this before. I don't think you remember it, because I know I didn't. When I went back and checked my notes and said, this name sounds familiar.
I remember it, but I honestly had not made the connection.
Well, you know, we've gone through a lot of changes over time, and I prefer that we have the opportunity now to interview, because back then, I was pretty terrible. I've had a little bit of practice now, and I've had even more time to research you and research the things that you've done and written about, and you know, it's my pleasure to have you here now so I can tackle you and say, I want to talk about these things that you've written.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
The book that made me aware of you, I was sent an advanced copy of Why We Believe in Gods. And this is a very short book, but it's a fairly concise description of the way that we now have an understanding of the cognitive elements of faith. This is what this book is about. Could you explain and elaborate that a little bit for us?
Certainly. I think this is one of the most important developments of the beginning of the 21st century, and it is not widely known. This is the first generation in the history of the world that has before them basically a comprehensive psychological science of religious belief. We now know how and why human minds generate religious beliefs. We know the mechanisms, the main mechanisms that are used. We know the things that make us all vulnerable to generate religious beliefs, to be vulnerable to supernatural beliefs. And the mechanisms are not complicated. They're everyday mechanisms. And this is available for a curious high school student can understand this.
And what about this idea, like you're saying that this is something that's comprehensible now, that we know the functioning of the brain. And I think that if you read comments out there from people, you know, where they say you can't explain love, you can't explain all these things, is the problem now that we face is that the evidence is there, but the knowledge about it is not?
Yes, I think the problem before us is really explanatory. And you're already seeing a lot of books, not just my book, but numerous others that are out there that weren't available 10, 15 years ago. And we're just in the phase now, I think, of getting to a tipping point. And this is the first part of the hill to that tipping point. But the evidence is there. And like you say about love, we largely know the circuits in the brain involved in sexual desire, romantic love, attachment, companionate love. The elements of that are known. We can explain it in psychological and cognitive neuroscience ways.
Do you think that there's a tendency for people to want to ignore this evidence because they fear it so much? Like, is there a conscious effort, or is it just largely that, you know, even a believer might not even fully comprehend just how devastating such an analysis might be on their faith?
Good question. I think it's largely that two things. I think people are getting on with their lives. I mean, it's hard to live in the world. It's hard to make a living. And the second part, I think, is education. This is not part of a general education. I think in 10, 15 years, this material, the material about religion, will be in your psychology 101 textbook in colleges. Right now it's not, but it will have to be for a textbook to be modern.
Is America really, do you think that it might be a bit slow, a bit reticent to start really shifting or changing its educational attitudes about the brain? I mean, there is a lot of, I mean, well, at least on the smaller scale in terms of public, you know, high schools and things like that, that's just impossible. But even in academic circles, I mean, there are still religious peoples. Would they be reticent to accept that notion as well? I mean, it seems fairly reductionist of their beliefs.
I think they are going to be resistant. At the same time, you're not going to be able to have a psychology textbook that is approved for use in colleges that doesn't cover what is known about psychological science. And the material that is out there now is increasingly in mainstream psychology research journals. So it'll have to be in a textbook for a textbook to be accepted for use in college introductory psychology courses.
Do you think that psychology has done an effective job at changing its image? Because, you know, if I was to ask someone, what do you think that psychology means now, or psychiatry, modern psychiatric care, what does it involve? And I think that a lot of people probably have these absurd ideas about what it is, or probably completely wrong.
Well, I think there's two different things there. There's psychology, basically human nature, the psychology that we should have when we're in college, just the nature of human nature. And then there's psychiatry, which is the treatment of mental illness. And they're two different things. And obviously, mental illness is the dysfunction, the disturbance of fundamental psychology, of fundamental human nature.
This is what you primarily study, right? You have one of your many jobs is a forensic psychiatrist. Is that right?
Yes, I do what's called general psychiatry, meaning I treat adults who have emotional illnesses. I do forensic psychiatry, which is doing evaluations of individuals who are in trouble with the law or who are involved in some kind of court process, like child custody evaluations, people who are charged with crimes where there's a question of competence, people who are charged with crimes where there's a question of their mental state at the time of the offense, the insanity defense. Those are some of my jobs.
So here's what I'm curious about in terms of what you do in a more general sense. Have you defined a mental illness in a way that, say, as a professional, you're actually able to quantify it properly? Because, you know, I remember hearing some horror stories where this one professor had taken a number of grad students, told them to go to a mental institution and claim to have heard voices and to do so only once, and it was an impossible thing to get them out. Like, almost that once you are part of that system, there's a tendency to regard that individual through a kind of lens, and that may be sort of like an issue. Is the diagnosis of mental illness, for instance, part and parcel of say, the problem of mental illness? Does it augment it? Does it create sometimes mental illness where none might occur?
I think that's rare. And I think that is a very famous study. At the same time, it's the responsibility of those clinicians who interviewed those students who were lying to protect their lives. And if they're coming in saying they've got hallucinations, it indicates that they may have a psychotic illness. And so you would admit them to the hospital if you thought they were acutely psychotic to protect their lives. And once people are in the hospitals and they realize how rough hospitals can be, they will also lie about not having the symptoms because they want to get out. And so that study, even though it's famous, is a little bit more complex.
Right.
If those students had shown up in my emergency room and they were claiming that they were hallucinating voices and they were paranoid, I would get them in a hospital and I would try to evaluate them, see what is going on. But if they suddenly told me they were no longer hallucinating and they were not paranoid anymore, I would have doubts about whether that was true, and I would be very careful about discharging someone who I thought might be acutely psychotically ill.
So it could be more of a symptom of, say, a person's overzealousness at diagnosing than a problem with the diagnosing tools?
Well, I don't necessarily think it's overzealousness in diagnosing. You have to be careful. You want to err on the side of patient safety. You want to err on the side of protecting the person's life. The highest rates of suicide are actually among young males who are having a first break psychotic illness, and you want to protect them.
Right. It tends to be their ability to actually follow through on suicide that tends to make the numbers that you know, as high as they are, right? That females will try more often, but fail more often, is what I understand.
Exactly. Suicide gestures are more frequent in women. Lethal suicide attempts are more frequent in men. And if you had a young male coming in who's claiming he's hallucinating, basically he's saying he's losing his mind. And it's a terrifying thing to experience. And the top on your list of potential diagnoses is a paranoid schizophrenic illness. And a young adult who has that illness is at risk for suicide. And you want to protect their life.
I'm going to take a wild guess and assume that all of your work with individuals with mental illness is the reason why you wrote this book. Do you see religion in that same prism? Is it a mental illness?
No, I don't think it's a mental illness. I think it's a vulnerability of human nature.
But you have to admit, though, many of the times it does seem to have a lot of the same qualities, like that a person with a lot of with that can often be undiagnosed by others are extremely religious. They can mask their insanity, in a sense, in that religion.
Oh, yes. It's a very complex question, because religion is a kind of delusional belief, and extreme delusions can be part of a schizophrenic illness. And you can have individuals that suddenly develop intense religiosity, and what underlies it is temporal lobe epilepsy, the onset of temporal lobe epilepsy. So it's a very complex picture. But I don't think we're served by saying that religion is a mental illness.
Right.
Or religious belief is a mental illness. I think we don't want to go there. I don't think it's accurate.
The purpose of the book itself, you're saying, well, I want to educate individuals. But what do you ultimately want them to come out of? Is it more finely crafted argument? Do you believe that sort of making that analysis can actually help erode a person's faith?
I hope. I think the evidence is that you are not going to argue somebody out of it, because people's religious beliefs are tied up with their identity. There's wonderful work by Sam Harris. Most people think of him, of course, as, you know, The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation and some of his other books. But Sam Harris is also a neuroscientist, and he's got an excellent neuroimaging study out there that shows that religious belief is in the same part of your brain as your identity. And so trying to argue somebody out of their faith rarely works. Where most people, I think, move away from religious belief is when they quietly, in the privacy of their own mind, think through the facts. And so my book is an attempt to lay out the facts, and my hope is that when an individual who might be religious looks at the facts, looks at this evidence, they may step back from religious belief. And it's been very gratifying. I've had a number of people tell me that they've given my book or had people watch on YouTube some of my lectures, and it has made people question their religious belief.
Well, when you said that in that study there was some element that seemed to be tied into your identity, are there certain techniques which allow us to help craft a person's identity, to help change it? Because if it is linked to it, maybe there are certain, I don't know, steps that individual that we can take, maybe using that information to say, well, maybe if we craft a different identity for a person to make them more empathetic towards others, make them more educated and so on and so forth, then that will erode their religious faith.
Yes, I think education is the key, and encouraging people to look at the facts, to look at this material, to see what they think. And I think that's the way you get people to back away from, one of the ways I think that people will back away from religion. Identity is a very complex thing, and one element of it can be religious belief.
Well, I found one of your papers about someone's complex, the way they identify themselves and the complexities of that. It was actually Harvey Oswald, as many of you hopefully know, was assassinated President Kennedy. And I remember I was just very intrigued. I used to believe I used to be a big conspiracy theory head, and I particularly really bought into the conspiracy for JFK because I read The Lone Assassin, and I think you know that book by Jim Garrison.
Yeah.
And his
yeah. I was drawn in by that myself.
You were? Oh, you did read the book?
Yeah. No, I was born and raised in Alexandria, Virginia, which is right outside Washington, D.C. And the Kennedy assassination was very vivid for me. I was a sophomore in high school, and a friend of mine and I went over to the funeral and right there in front of the church, and it was a very vivid part of my youth. And when Garrison came up with what looked like an explanation, I was taken in, as a lot of people were. And I was a conspiracy believer, and you don't want to think that such a horrendous event could be done by a lone, pathetic individual. And unfortunately, the evidence is that it was done. That is what happened. And what happened, and for any listener who's interested in this, I thought it was a conspiracy, and it just had to be. And then many years later, I read Posner's book, Case Closed. And he's a Wall Street Journal reporter who's also a lawyer. And he went into his investigation of the Kennedy assassination thinking it must be a conspiracy. And when he'd examined all the evidence, he came to the conclusion that it was Oswald alone. And he wrote what I think is a superb book, anyone who's interested in this. And it was his book that triggered my interest, because I thought he had laid out the evidence for Oswald being guilty, but he had not taken his evidence as far as I thought he might in terms of formulating the reasons that Oswald might have killed JFK.
Which seems to be the major confusion amongst people who believe in the conspiracy, because admittedly, I understood the physical evidence. I understood all of that, but the part that really fascinated me about that paper that you wrote was the fact that it finally gave me a picture of the man himself. I had tried to read the book Reclaiming History. I don't know, I'm trying to remember the author, but in any case, it's a behemoth, and it gave me severe wrist pains. So I put that one down, saying I'm going to get back to you later or something like that. But you know, your paper really summarized it very effectively, and I thought to myself, this should be a screenplay. Seriously, we need to make this movie. It needs to exist, because understanding Oswald makes everything else about the assassination suddenly seem less striking, less important. I mean, even when you mention, I think at the end, where there was a time where it probably wouldn't have gone down if he would have just gotten a bit of attention that day.
Yes, I think if the evidence is that if his wife had responded differently to him the night or two before when he came home, maybe it wouldn't have happened.
Right. Well, it was clear that something was going to happen, though, with this guy.
Oh, yes. No, I mean, he was destined for trouble. He'd already tried to assassinate the retired general who was a political figure whose name I'm
George Walker, so something Walker, I don't know.
General Walker, yeah, General Walker. He was the one who tried to kill Walker. No, I think he would have tried to kill somebody, but he may not have succeeded in killing the president.
It's a rare kind of moment in time, like it's partially a crime of opportunity, even though there was some planning. It's just sort of it reveals the fact that these large fracturing moments are often just arbitrary, and
yes.
And that's the part that's so shocking. I think that's what feeds into the conspiracy that people have.
Yeah, that such a momentous event, you know, must be a momentous event must be motivated by momentous reasons, and that a pathetic loner could have done this is hard for people to accept, and was hard for people to accept.
I think we're just going to continue to see that in most other important events. Like, I don't think that's going to change.
Well, one of the tragedies of the Kennedy assassination report was that the Warren Commission basically had it right. And there's an interesting story. I happened to meet a man who was actually writing a book about the Warren Commission. And it's a sad story that Governor Connally was one of the ones who said there couldn't be one assassin, that there had to be multiple assassins, because certainly the second shot couldn't have done the damage to him that it did, which referred to as the magic bullet. And he managed to get, I think, Richard Russell, who was on the Warren Commission, he managed to get Richard Russell to have the commission sort of muddy the language in the final paragraphs of conclusion. They had it all laid out quite clearly. And if you pull out a copy of the Warren Commission report and look at the conclusions, it's very well laid out till it gets to about the next to the last paragraph, and suddenly it becomes mushy. And then it's because Connolly would not accept that the second bullet did all the damage to him. And the evidence is, of course, just overwhelming and incontrovertible that it did. But former Governor Connolly was able to bring enough pressure to bear, I think it was on Senator Russell and some of the other political members of the commission, that they forced an alteration in the writing of the final report. The investigation was basically done by a group of young U.S. attorneys. They were the ones who really did all the work and did all the writing.
Which explains their objectivity, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very good... It's a very good report, but unfortunately, some political pressure was brought to bear that made the conclusions at the very end about the second bullet kind of mushy. And I think it's one of the things that opened the door to further to conspiracy theories.
Well, it's interesting to note, though, that the Kennedy conspiracy didn't really start. It was years after, many, many years after the assassination that it really started to pop up. And I'm trying to wonder, sort of, is that the expression of one, say, a generation that had experienced it but didn't understand it? Was it sort of like the people living within the generation that were more likely to believe the conspiracy?
I don't know the history of that. I don't know the history of when the Garrison started his investigation or when the conspiracy theories started to come up. Oliver Stone, of course, bought it hook, line, and sinker and made that movie JFK, which is a well-done movie, but is completely inaccurate. And I think that certainly reinforced it. But I don't know the history of when the conspiracy theories took off. But one of the things that opened the door was, unfortunately, the conclusions of the Warren Commission after they had all the evidence.
I still wonder to this day what happened to the people that Garrison kind of needlessly dragged into the mud during his whole adventure escapade thing. The people in Louisiana that, like, Clay, yes. Clay Bertrand or Shaw. I forget which one is actually his name.
Yeah, Clay Bernard Shaw, something like that. Yeah. One does wonder what happened to those individuals.
Yeah, it seems as though. I don't think that, I would imagine myself in their shoes having been aggrandized for no reason, for non-participation in something, saying like, what? We didn't do nothing.
Yeah. No, it must have been tragic for them to be brought into that and to make it look like they were part of killing the President of the United States and JFK.
I think it's great as an example, too, of watching the way in which misinformation carries. Like, for instance, lots of the misinformation about, say, Oswald's either motivations or some of the physical evidence that people are just convinced, like when you talk to them, someone would be like, oh, those photos were faked with him holding the rifle because the shadows are wrong or something like that. Or somebody else will tell you that, heads don't go back when you shoot them from the back, even though they do. It seems almost like how do you get through when you're just like, I have facts, and yet these people have sort of this common quote unquote knowledge that's not really knowledge.
Yeah, it's an attractive meme that gets out there and people want to believe it, and it goes against the facts. One of the problems with the Kennedy assassination was that there were some things that were not known at the time of the Warren Commission. Like the Soviets had not been forthcoming about Oswald's life while he was living in Russia. And anybody interested in this, Norman Mailer actually wrote a very good book about Oswald in Russia once the information came out. And there's another excellent book about this called Marina and Lee. And I can't remember the woman who wrote that book, but anybody who's listening, the three books to read are Case Closed, Norman Mailer's book on Oswald, and then the book Marina and Lee. And you can't not read those books and you come away from those books and it's just overwhelming that Oswald did it, and you can see the reasons.
One of the interesting things that you alluded to in that article was the suggestion that he may have been sexually abused by his mother. And, I mean, it's difficult to really say for certain, obviously. But there does seem to be a lot of strangeness there with him having, you know, sort of being in his bed and his mother having this, you know, almost sense of you know, self-aggrandizement and viewing her own child as an extension of herself. Does a person go from being potentially sane to just slowly driven insane as someone else's alter ego, like in that sense? Like, do they lose all compassion? Are they just missing parts of their emotion? What do you think was made him so detached from reality?
Well, I think you can make the argument that he was a very disturbed man. And how much of that was a product of his experiences? How much of that was the personality structure he was born with? His mother was somewhat antisocial. How much of personality structure, how much is experience, one doesn't know. One of the interesting things about Oswald is that he was actually psychiatrically hospitalized at age 14, and those records are available. And so you have this window into Oswald's life at age 14 that is not distorted by his subsequent fame. And it's tragic. It's just he had a very sad developmental history. Whereas his older brothers largely escaped it, he was the youngest and I think the most damaged by his mother.
Well, and he was the closest one to her. She sent the other ones to an orphanage. They were a product of the system, and they turned out better than being close to a crazy mom.
Yes, and his older brother, Robert, actually, by all accounts, is a very decent man, I think, and who I think is still alive, and a good citizen, and I'm sure his brother's actions significantly hurt his life.
Well, the thing that seemed to strike me as well was there's a strong association, it seems, with his own sexual impotence, and it's you know, like that Kennedy appeared to look like a former lover of his wife that he had married that he didn't really love, and just this complicated, I don't know, these feelings of sexual desire but also repulsiveness or something like that, like into the mix. Do you think that was a big part of the desire to kill Kennedy? Was there a sexual component to it?
Oh, I think you can make the case that one of the reasons that he killed Kennedy was that his wife had a short time before had told him about an affair she had had while they were married, while she was pregnant with, I think, their first child, while they were in Russia. And so he was enraged about that. And she also was in love with Kennedy because Kennedy had reminded her of a medical student in Russia that she was in love with. And she had Kennedy's picture up. And I think Oswald could sense that his wife admired and adored Kennedy. And he was hurt and he was wounded by that and by the news of the affair. It was a marriage in which he was possessive, abusive, and you can make the case that at least one thread of his motivation was a kind of male sexual jealousy towards JFK.
Now, you've worked, obviously, for quite some time as a forensic psychiatrist. Are there instances where are there a lot of red flags like these types of people? Is it a fairly rare occurrence or a lot more common than we think, but these people don't act on these impulses?
Fortunately, it's rare. Unfortunately, we have to have the Secret Service because there are people out there who want to kill figures of prominence. And the Secret Service probably stops a few people every year, would be my guess.
So, really committed individuals, you're like, if you were just given all the chances in the world. Well, you know, there's quite a few presidents that have been shot. If I remember correctly, Theodore Roosevelt was shot, and he continued his inauguration address, despite having been shot, and I think it was like an hour.
Oh, it's an extraordinary story. He was shot in the chest, and the bullet lodged in a folded up speech that was in his pocket, or a book that was in his pocket, and he kept on talking and finished the speech. But we came very close to losing Teddy Roosevelt to an assassin's bullet, and I think there was an assassination attempt on FDR also. I'm not sure about this, but it was either stopped or the person in the car next to him was shot or something like that.
And don't forget poor Garfield. He got shot before he was able to start taxing the churches, which he definitely planned on doing. He was shot by a preacher.
No, I was worried in the first Obama campaign when the hate rhetoric against Obama had escalated. I was genuinely worried somebody would feel like they had permission to go after the candidate.
Is it almost like a copycat crime or something? Like, it just seems to have, maybe the psychotic people seem to have a fascination with the president because someone else did or something. I don't know. Was there a starting point to all of this? It just seems very strange.
Well, these people are not automatically going to be psychotic. You will have people who are technically sane who will do something like this, who feel aggrieved and feel justified, and who are not suffering from a psychotic illness. You will also have individuals who are disturbed, who are psychotic. I did a case several years ago of a gentleman with paranoid schizophrenia who was climbing over the wall of the Virginia governor's mansion. And he was going. He was headed to kill the governor and had paranoid schizophrenia. So he was crazy. He was fortunately stopped.
But was there a particular reason why he chose someone in government? Like, because there's lots of people that have authority or power, but why is it that it's people in government? Is there some kind of paternal thing in a way? I mean,
well, I think it's high status males. I think they're going after the high status male, the alpha male, and there's some fascination with him. It's not just presidents. Obviously, John Lennon was taken out.
It's almost like that, like monkey behavior. I'm the shitty beta male who got crapped on his whole life, and now I'm just going to try to take down this alpha because I have a gun.
I think there's elements of that, and we're apes too. We're African apes.
I mean, I don't know myself. I always wondered how much of our behavior is really mimicked. I know that Jane Goodall, for instance, she claims that it's the full range. I'm not so sure because of, you know, I think during one of your talks you mentioned higher order thinking. And I think that higher order thinking has a huge effect on our mood that I don't think a lot of other animals might possess.
Well, we have a degree of consciousness and self-reflection probably that other apes do not have. But if you just take, say, 9/11, that's male-bonded coalitionary violence with surprise lethal raiding against innocents. Chimpanzees do the same thing. And probably all males of our species have that capacity for male coalitionary bonding and violence, lethal raiding against innocents. All of us have that, all males have that capacity.
Yeah, the old boys club that gets together and clubs people.
Yeah. I mean, gang violence. And so I think we need to be humble before the facts of our evolutionary history.
My hope is always that if we can understand it, at least in that way. I know that a lot of people are hesitant to do so because a lot of these issues are controversial. Who really wants to talk about what is the evolutionary reason for rape, for instance, in our society? As soon as you open your mouth about something like that, it's going to be far too controversial for people to really want to talk about.
Yes, yet at the same time, I think there is a discussion going on that would not have gone on in my youth. I mean, I'm 63 years old, and the world now is much different from the world I grew up in, and yes, there you have the discussions about rape and they're controversial, but one is having discussions and the ideas about some of the evolved potential mechanisms for rape inherent in all males, that certainly wasn't widely discussed in my youth or my young adulthood, my training. And so I think we've actually come a long way, even though it's controversial. It's getting discussed, and I think the more it gets discussed, the more it gets understood, the more you have an opportunity for preventing it.
Now, you also study evolutionary psychology, from what I understand. What do you think the challenge of this is? Because I've read quite a number of books on it, and I feel like the problem is, here's a bold claim, here's very little evidence to support it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Well, again, I think the meme that's out there is it's a bold claim with little evidence. I think it's a clear claim, and I think there's a lot of evidence. And there's a lot more evidence, say, than what we had for so many years in my profession with psychoanalysis. I think evolutionary psychology is not only here to stay, but we finally have the basic framework for all psychology. The mind is what the brain does. The brain, like every other piece of living tissue, evolved by the rules of natural selection. And once you start looking at psychology through an evolutionary lens, a lot more becomes clear.
Since you work with the University of Virginia, you must be seeing the next generation of students, of people that work in your field. And what's your general impression of the way that things are moving? Like, is it going to be another rapid change? Because you said there's been change within your lifetime. But, you know, there's that one limit where all of a sudden, you know, the old guard doesn't even have anything left to just try to hold on to. The new guard's just taking it over, and it's a complete revolution in a sense. Are we headed in that direction?
I think we're in the midst of it. And as they say, science progresses one funeral at a time. And as the old guard retires and steps aside, I think the new generation is in a much better position. I think we know a lot more. We have a lot more tools than we did when I was doing my training. The functional neuroimaging has just been a pardon the phrase, a godsend. It's just marvelous. And what for this generation is just sort of routine, everyday stuff, to me is still magic. The three-dimensional imaging of the brain, living brains, doing things, actually able to watch the brain as it does things, just it's marvelous.
I even read somewhere that they had begun very primitive recordings of thought patterns. It all looks pretty blurry right now, but you know where this is headed.
Oh, yes. No, I think it's just marvelous. I think that we're in the midst of a revolution in the neurosciences, in the cognitive neurosciences, in the abilities to see the brain in action at every level, at a circuit level, and right down to a molecular synaptic level. It's just marvelous. And it's so, we've come so far just in my lifetime.
It's shocking. I don't think that most people even understand when you say there are more scientists alive now than had ever lived in the history of mankind. And it's still something that a person is going to have trouble wrestling their brains in, because they're going to probably think, why in my lifetime? Why am I living in this age? What's happening?
Who knows? But it's just marvelous. I went to medical school in 1970. So, you know, I started medical school 42 years ago, and looking back at what was available then seems almost like the dark ages.
And what do you think the biggest challenge is going to be? Say you and I are long dead, and there's new generations of human beings. What do you think the challenge that they're going to face is? I mean, if you just had to guess. I mean, think you're someone living in the Industrial Revolution trying to guess what people in the modern age are going to be living through. Obviously, it might be crazy, but you might be onto something. Do you think that do you see some element that is going to be like our defining moment as a species?
Well, I think the challenge is going to be what constitutes a good education. there's so much information available. How do we determine what is the core curriculum? How do we determine what an educated citizen should have?
Well, especially in terms of how do you prepare for a future that you can't predict?
Exactly.
And I've heard countless talks about that very issue. And I mean, it's weird. Like, we have to kind of imagine a future that is almost impossible to imagine.
Yes. And the increase in computing power just in our lifetime, and we know it's exponential, so computing power is going to increase even greater. And where's that going to lead? I mean, it's just going to be, I think we can't even begin to imagine.
I always joke that the part where I'm going to be that old fogey that's telling everybody to get off my lawn is when my kids or grandkids are going to be like, oh, just plug yourself into the internet, Dad. You'll live forever there. And I'm just like, that's it. I'm out for this train.
Yeah, well, somebody was, I read someplace or heard someplace doing an interview with Neil Armstrong, I think a couple years ago, obviously before he died. And he said something to the effect of there was more computing power in his iPhone than in the entire Apollo project or something like that.
Yeah. And most pocket calculators were more complicated than the shuttle craft.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just marvelous. And I mean, we're talking on Skype over the internet, and we could do it with cameras. You can now do the video Skype. To me, that's magic.
I always thought back in the day when people were like, oh, we'll have a video phone. That's silly. Who's going to want to talk? You know, it's better to just talk on the phone. That way they don't know when you look silly. And again, it you know, you're that old fogey that's like, no one's going to like this video phone idea.
Yeah. Well, the one advantage of getting old is you really appreciate the technology. It's just every day seems like a magic show.
Well, yeah, but then it becomes a bit harder to really follow. Then you just feel lost. And it's like, oh, how does this new thing work? What's interest?
Yeah.
What the hell? Is this a new thing I have to learn now? This is exhausting.
Yeah, no, it can be at times, that's for sure.
Well, before we go, there is one last question I wanted to ask you, and this is specific to the atheism scene because you've done quite a few conferences and things like that. Are you still doing lectures? Are you still, should people be looking for you to book out or things like that? Like, what is your plan for doing these in the future? Because, the two lectures that I will provide in the link, they're fantastic. I think that
you should
be definitely doing more of them. Would you be open to doing that?
Oh yeah, no, I think this is very important material. I will, when I can get away from my job, I will go anywhere and give this talk. Anybody that will have me, I'm happy to do it.
So you are available if people go out and they reach you, if they say, Jacob told me that I could get a hold of you and try to do something.
Certainly. And these days, the obviously people are pressed for time, but most of the material in the book is in the talk that's on YouTube that's been seen by a lot of people, Why We Believe in Gods, that is American Atheist 2009. An updated talk is, if you just Google Andy Thompson, Imagine No Religion 2, a conference in Canada, they filmed the talk, and it's not as well filmed as the first talk, but it's got more information and it's updated. And, I can send you that link, but that's an easy way too. I mean, I'm more than happy to come give you the talk, but if you want to see it quick, it's on
the magical tubes that we love so much.
Yeah, both of them are on YouTube. The purpose of the book, too, for people that are interested, the purpose of the book was to, again, give people a concise, quick introduction. The whole design of the book was something that was easy to digest, that you could read in an hour, hour and a half, and it was to, the design was for it to be cheap. It didn't come out in hardback. It's just paperback and electronic, and the more I think we can get, I would just like to see the idea out there that we understand why people believe.
Well, it's breaking apart those old suppositions that people have about, you know, different sciences. I mean, like we said before, things change so fast, they evolve so rapidly that people's image of those fields that evolve are all wrong.
True. And the other thing that's interesting about this is that it was right before us. I mean, it didn't take much for the pieces of the puzzle to fit together, because what religion is based on are everyday cognitive mechanisms that were originally designed for other purposes. Our attachment system, our agency detection, all these things that are absolutely crucial for day-to-day living, for the functioning of our mind, they combine in a slightly different way, and boom, you've got religious ideas and religious beliefs. It just took a couple of researchers to piece it together, and it's there.
Well, the impetus had to be there to understand it. And I think that, like most religious people that you probably talk to, there's always that, well, I don't really want to know. You need faith. Why do we need to find out? Mystery is better. And I don't think that people who take science, seriously, take that argument seriously for one second.
No, and they shouldn't. And I think another layer to this, though, which is alluded to in your question, is that I think children have a fundamental right to be protected from religious indoctrination. I think children have a right not to have their minds limited, that their horizons blocked. And that's another part of the message, that children should be protected from religious indoctrination, and that they should have an opportunity to see what science tells us about the cosmos, about humanity, and about the psychology, the basic psychology of human nature.
Well, I think what's great about your book is that, like you said before, it's concise. I view it as a kind of pocketbook, that these arguments are things that people can easily memorize because they're easy to understand, like you said before. They're accessible to the layperson because they're not complicated. The hard work has been done. That's
right.
The beauty. You don't need to go out and find out how the brain works. Somebody, a whole bunch of really smart people did for you, and now you stand on the shoulders of giants. All you have to do is become familiar with the arguments, and when you have conversations with people, you can be at least understanding and intelligible and explain to them why they do believe, and that's what I think is useful.
Right, and you can point out the mechanisms that they're using to believe that are the mechanisms they use in their everyday life. Yeah, and your mention of the pocket idea, the pocketbook. I mean, we literally designed the book so that it would fit in your suit pocket, and it was part of the design that was in mind.
If I held on to physical books, which I don't anymore because I just don't have the room anymore, it's all electronic. But if I did, it'd be a good one in my pocket. And plus, if I get shot by a crazy assassin dude, it might just save my life. Right?
Well, I don't know if... No, it's not
Oh, it's not thick,
thick.
Enough.
It's not thick enough. Yeah. It's not thick enough.
The bullets are better now, too.
Right, and the bullets are better than the ones that were probably shot at Teddy Roosevelt. But the book is not quite thick enough, I think, to stop a bullet.
Damn, can you print one with, like, metal covers or something? That might be a solution. You know, have a dual purpose. It's a pocketbook thing and protects you from assassination attempts.
It'll protect you from the fundamentalist that wants to take you out.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Andy Thompson, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.